Good morning. Welcome to Prairie Unitarian Universalist Society, where you are welcome no matter what your theological bent, or the color of your skin, or whom you choose to love, you are welcome. We always encourage visitors and new folks to come back and see us more than once because every Sunday can be a little different. Sometimes the services are done by people within, lay people within our congregation. Sometimes I do them, the Reverend Sandra L. Ingham. Sandy is fine. And often we have outside speakers. The opening words are by William Henry Channing, William Ellery Channing's nephew. William Henry Channing was born in 1810. To live content with small means, to seek elegance rather than luxury, and refinement rather than fashion, to be worthy, not respectable, and wealthy, not rich, to study hard, think quietly, talk gently, act frankly, to listen to stars and birds, to babes and sages with open heart, to bear all cheerfully, do all bravely, await occasions, hurry never, to let the spiritual, unbidden and unconscious, grow up through the common. This is to be my symphony. Mary, would you please light the chalice? May the flame here lit be to us a symbol of the torch that is passed from hand to hand and life to life of caring and concern and the passion for involvement which have marked the men and women of our liberal faith for many generations. The reading I would like to share with you this morning was written by the Reverend David S. Blanchard, who when I was the minister in Plattsburgh was the minister in, I want to say Utica, but that doesn't sound quite right. Yes, David was, now he's in Canton. New York. At any rate, he writes this, and he prefaces his writing, his little essay here, with a quote from, and I never say this correctly, Rabindranath Tagore. And this is the quote. I have spent my days stringing and unstringing my instrument while the song I came to sing remains unsung. David writes this. On sabbatical in East Africa, I heard a story of a people who believe that we are each created with our own song. Their tradition as a community is to honor that song by singing it as a welcome when a child is born, as a comfort when the child is ill, in celebration when the child marries, and in affirmation and love when death comes. Most of us were not welcomed into the world in that way. Few of us seem to know our song. It takes a while for many of us to figure out which is our song and which is the song that others would like us to sing. Some of us are slow learners. I heard my song, writes Blanchard, not necessarily from doing extraordinary things in exotic places, but also from doing some pretty ordinary things in some routine places. For every phrase I heard climbing Kilimanjaro, I learned another in a chair in a therapist's office. For every measure I heard in the silence of a retreat, I heard another laughing with my girls. For every note I heard in the wind on the beach at Lamoo, I gleaned more from spending time with a dying friend as her children sang her song back to her. What came to astound me was not that the song appeared, but that it was always there. I figure that the only way I could have known it for my own was if I had heard it before. Before memory went to work, making sense and order out of the mystery of our beginning. Our songs sing back to us something of our essence, something of our truth, something of our uniqueness. When our songs are sung back to us, it is not about approval, but about recognizing our being and our belonging in the human family. It is good to know our songs by heart for those lonely times when the world is not singing them back to us. That's usually a good time to start humming to yourself that song that is most your own. Blanchard concludes, they can be heard as songs of love or of longing, songs of encouragement or of comfort, songs of struggle or of security. But most of all, they are the songs of life, giving testimony to what has been, giving praise for all we're given, giving hope for all we strive for, giving voice to the great mystery that carries each of us in and out of this world. David Blanchard was mainly referring to individuals in this reading, but I think his words are equally applicable to organizations. It seems to me that it is just as important for institutions, especially those institutions concerned with religion, the mysterious, the sacred, that which ultimately concerns us. I believe that it is just as important for an organization to find its song as it is for individuals to do so. I suppose that all people and all organizations, including political entities, find their song in one way or another, often by default, I suspect, and perhaps too often, subconsciously or unthinkingly. Every year when the 4th of July rolls around again, I wonder what song the citizens of this country are listening for or to. I do not like the 4th of July. It is my least favorite holiday. Our so-called celebrations too often miss the significance of what happened in July of 1776, or if you want to be more historically accurate, 1778. I don't think we remember and celebrate this country's song when we talk about the 4th of July. I am extremely wary of patriotism, especially that word, and flag waving. It depresses me that in this month of July, we don't talk much about the incredible process of turning the British colonies into one united country made up of several states. We seldom pay any attention to what happened in the late 1600s on this continent through the mid 1800s that enabled this amazing place we call the United States of America to come into existence. I am patriotic in my own way. Who were these people who wrote and signed the Declaration of Independence and drafted and put into law the groundbreaking Constitution of the United States? Who or what influenced them? And have they become irrelevant. My original intention when planning this morning's service was to continue what I started in May, a look at Unitarian Universalist history. You may recall, if you were here then, that I did not have time then to say much about our history on this continent because I never got out of Europe. I used all my time in May to talk about Unitarianism and Universalism in Europe. But I changed my mind about what I wanted to say today when I rediscovered a gem of a book that I had forgotten about. Revolutionary Spirits, The Enlightened Faith of America's Founding Fathers, written by Unitarian Universalist minister Gary Kowalski. This is a relatively new book. I think it was published in 2010. The book features six of the founding fathers: Benjamin Franklin, George Washington, Thomas Paine, John Adams, Thomas Jefferson, and James Madison, who were contemporaries. Kowalski thinks, as do I, that despite all that has been written about the founders of our country, we really don't know much about or don't appreciate enough who they really were, what their spiritual life was all about, why they believed, what they did, about that which ultimately concerns the human race. The stories of these founding fathers are part of the same stories that we tell about our faith tradition's early history in America. I mean our early Unitarian and Universalist history. So while I started out to talk about that, I ended up more here with the revolutionaries in our history. Of course, I didn't do this till yesterday, but that's all right. As religion evolved to become less about superstition and fear, I know we can make a case that that's still what it's about, but as it evolved to become hopefully less about superstition and fear and more about what it means to be human, creativity and imagination and new ideas began to flourish at just the right time to influence the founders of our country. So this morning I would like to share some stories about this flourishing and about the men who became enlightened at just the right time to have a profound influence on the creation of our country and how our government would be organized. Obviously, an influence that still greatly affects us. Unfortunately, because of time constraints and lack of research, I am going to ignore the women's stories this morning. I would like to explore the subject of our founding mothers, but that will have to wait for another day. There were a lot of revolutionary conversations going on in the British colonies in the 1600s and 1700s and early 1800s as the ideas of the Enlightenment spread first in Europe and then to the Americas. And these conversations were often the beginnings of all kinds of revolt, political, social, religious. And there was a lot to revolt against. Kowalski tells us that January 17, 1706, is a pretty good date to pick for what he calls the beginning of an intellectual awakening in North America. That happens to be Benjamin Franklin's birth date. But a lot changed between that day and the day when John Adams and Thomas Jefferson both died, July 4th, 1826. Imagine living here in North America in the late 1600s, when fear of the supernatural and belief in astrology were common. In 1689, four children in Boston who had convulsions were diagnosed as, quote, sadly molested with evil spirits, capitalized evil and spirits, unquote. These are the words of the Reverend Cotton Mather, who made the diagnosis. Mather, as some of you may remember, was a strict, charismatic Puritan, aka Calvinist, aka Presbyterian minister. The woman who was charged with enchanting the youngsters was tried and then hung. She really had no defense, it being difficult to defend yourself against the charge of supernatural wrongdoing. Mather didn't stop there. He wrote about this incident, and he managed to whip up enough hysteria in a neighboring town, a place called Salem, to get 20 more people and two dogs executed. 19 of those people were hanged. One was pressed to death, which took 2 days. In 1707, Mather warned people not only about rabid and howling wolves in the woods of New England, but also about the dragons, droves of devils, and fiery flying serpents to be found in those same woods. It is important to remember, though, that Cotton Mather was not stupid. He was very intelligent. Apparently, he just wasn't engaging in enough revolutionary conversations. At about the same time, however, there were other religious events of an entirely different nature occurring in New England. In 1698, the Brattle Street Church in Boston was founded by a dissident group of Calvinists, Unitarians, but that word wasn't being used yet. At the time, they became known as, this is a quote, the most respectable body of heretics in the New World. The breakaway group that started the Brattle Street Church found the Puritan Calvinists to be too strict and demanding. This was also the same time period when both Unitarian and Universalist clergymen from England were coming to the New World and introducing radical new beliefs about the Trinity and the divinity of Jesus, and encouraging people in their congregations to read the Bible critically. We would today, I'd probably call this turmoil and this back and forthness pushback, a word we hear a lot today. You know, one side would push too far and the other side, well, would push back. And then everybody would switch. The Great Awakening in the 1740s, and the Great Awakening, for those of you who aren't familiar with it, was a revivalist movement, a religious movement. Have you ever been to a revivalist movement? I have. It was interesting. I was an adult, a young adult, when that happened. This Great Awakening divided the congregational churches, and eventually, by the early 1800s, led to a huge split in that denomination. This time, the breakaway group was given a name, a derogatory name, Unitarian. Liberals did not like the revivalist movement. It was too passionate and emotional for them. The liberals shunned a theological style that reflected an emotional conversion in favor of a slow educational process that was devoted to the conduct of life. We still struggle with this. We don't like passion and emotion, generally speaking. That's one reason merging with the Universalists was a good thing. This is a quote from a book by Andrea Greenwood and Mark Harris, and the book is an introduction to the Unitarian and Universalist traditions. Greenwood and Harris go on to say that the deists, with a capital D, were the most rational of all the liberals. Deism, a movement or system of thought advocating natural religion, emphasizing morality, and in the 18th century denying the interference of the Creator, capital C, with the laws of the universe. Think about that. And consider this. Many of the founders of our country were deists, capital D, most notably Thomas Jefferson. The founders of this country were deists and liberals and progressive, and they described themselves with those three categories. They did identify themselves as Christians, but not exclusively as Christians. They never intended to found a Christian nation. They usually did not believe in the miracles described in the Bible, nor in the Trinity, nor in predestination, nor even in original sin, although John Adams apparently was never quite able to completely give up this belief. They believed in a God, but they would all have defined that God in different ways. They believed in the unity of the universe, and above all, they believed in the power of rational thought and the power of science. They had no trouble reconciling science and religion. The founders of this country believed that some of the systems found in nature, particularly in the solar system, could provide a model for government. They believed that science and critical thinking would save humanity. I wish there was time enough today to tell you at least something that you probably did not know about the six men featured in the book Revolutionary Spirits. But of course, there isn't time. There's never enough time. But I will have to be content with just a little something about two of them. First, John Adams. Adams had a Calvinist upbringing. This meant religious references would have been a big part of at least his early education. For example, learning the alphabet. In Adam's fall, this would be A, we sinned all. But by the time Adams was a young man, he was complaining bitterly of the doctrines of the, in his words, frigid John Calvin. Critical thinking will do this to you. Adams was wary of crowds of people because he knew that they could easily become dangerous mobs. In 1770, and I didn't know this, Adams defended the British soldiers who had fired on the crowds during the Boston Massacre, when those crowds threw rocks and snowballs at the soldiers. And for the same reason, Adams did not like religious revivals, believing, again a quote, they deliberately inflamed emotions that ran counter to reason and good order. I would have to agree. Adams thought about becoming a minister. Probably it would have been a Unitarian minister. But he decided against it after watching a spirit of dogmatism and bigotry in clergy and laity, his words, prevail when a new minister came to the church his family went to. And this minister was accused of not being orthodox enough. And this went on for 4 years. And it started when Adams was 10. I remember myself growing up Presbyterian, and I was a junior or senior in high school, and I worshiped the Presbyterian minister, and he had an affair with the choir director. Or maybe it was the organist. But at any rate, I could not believe what was coming out of the mouths of the adults, the Christian adults, the religious people who were, I mean, yes, they did something wrong and something they shouldn't have done. They eventually ran off together. But I couldn't get past the words and what they were trying to teach me on Sunday mornings. And this is not exclusive of Christianity. We would find, or Protestants, we would find this in any religious institution. Adams wrote, I perceived very clearly, as I thought, that the study of theology and the pursuit of it as a profession would involve me in endless altercations and make my life miserable without any prospect of doing any good to my fellow men. Wise man, I think I understand this. We are fortunate, though, as citizens of this country, that Adams did not go into ministry, but instead became an important part of our country's early history as a statesman and president. Adams' interest in and study of science, especially astronomy, led him to deep theological questions. He wondered how a God who created this immense solar system possibly could have been incarnated only once, and that in the form of a Galilean peasant 2,000 years ago, almost 2,000 years ago in Adams' lifetime. And why would such a cosmic deity, Adams' words here, indulge in petty human emotions of petulance or retribution and consign 9/10 of the human race to eternal fire? Adams' religion was this: the love of God, however you define that, and his creation, delight, joy, triumph, exaltation in my own existence, even though I'm but one atom. This is my religion, he said. For this, Adams and Jefferson, who expressed similar sentiments, were accused of being infidels. The Christian Watchman publication in 1823 chided the heathenish tendency of both presidents to speak of the divine in naturalistic rather than strictly biblical terms. John and Abigail Adams were influenced by the Reverend Richard Price, an Englishman who was initially a Presbyterian but became a Unitarian. Price believed that the perfect opportunity for complete religious liberty was in this new nation that we eventually called the United States. And for this to happen, Price said, there needed to be a system of education, and this is a quote, that teaches how to think rather than what to think. I have little notes in things I read, and one of my frequent notes is SNTC. Some things never change. Are we not still battling this education question? Adams, as you can see, made a long, fascinating journey from the Calvinism of his youth. Which brings me to James Madison, the youngest of the group. Even though we claim him as one of the five Unitarian presidents, Madison did not attend church, any church, very often. But his ideas, reflected in his writings, are Unitarian and Universalist. He was a staunch defender of separation and of church and state, as all the founders were, and he did not like the word tolerance, believing that it was not the opposite of intolerance, but, quote, the counterfeit of it. Both are despotisms, which I've never liked that word myself. With Jefferson, Madison dismantled the established Anglican church in their home state of Virginia. There is a lot of evidence that Madison was skeptical of established religion, though he believed that religion made for a healthy society. But was government necessary or healthy for religion, Madison asked. No, he answered, and cited examples from history to support his belief. Madison believed that spiritual diversity was absolutely necessary to American liberty. Spiritual diversity was absolutely necessary to American liberty. When was the last time you heard that on the 4th of July? Madison and Jefferson took trips together, primarily to study the earth sciences. They agreed with Thomas Paine's take on Noah and the ark. Jefferson wanted to know how there could be animals and birds that were found only in America if all animals had been on the ark. My opinion of this story, chuckled Tom Paine, is the same as what a man once said to another who asked him in a drawling tone of voice, Do you believe the account about Noah? The other replied in the same tone of voice, ah, no. Get it? N-O-A-H? A-H dash no? Okay, it's okay. 17th and 18th century humor is little different. Madison, like the rest of the founders of this country, had complete faith in science and what humans could learn by studying it. He agreed with John Dickinson of Delaware, who signed the Declaration of Independence, who said, let our central government be like the sun and the states the planets, repelled yet attracted, and the whole moving regularly and harmoniously in their separate orbits. Madison wondered if good government could be like the planetary system, regulated by fixed laws and presenting, in Madison's words, a scene of order and proportion. Ah, if only. When Madison was president, he broke his own rule about keeping religion and government separate by proclaiming, during the War of 1812, a national day of prayer, something he later regretted doing. But his declaration was worded in such a generic way that a disgruntled Bible Christian was, quote, unable to discover a single phrase which could be offensive to the ear of a pagan, an infidel, a deist, and scarcely to that of an atheist. As Kowalski says, the founders were busy constructing a modern nation that would serve as inspiration for a world aching to throw off a medieval heritage of cruelty and oppression, replacing fanaticism with careful rules of evidence. Some things never change. Superstition with solid science, and my favorite, fear of the unknown with faith in humanity's ability to explore and find out. What has happened to and in the good old US of A? Are we backsliding, especially in the area of fear of the unknown? In 1822, Thomas Jefferson predicted that, quote, there is not a young man now living in the United States who will not die a Unitarian. Little off. That obviously hasn't happened yet, but we're aiming for growth. These men were so ahead of their time. They were progressive even by today's standards. They understood the importance of being stewards of the earth so that it could be passed on to future generations. They experimented with what we would now call sustainable farming. They were environmentalists because being so was a part of their deist beliefs. Their faith in natural religion. There is ample evidence that they understood what multiculturalism meant. My problem with the 4th of July is that most people probably don't know enough about the founding fathers to intelligently and effectively debate their ideas, their revolutionary ideas. Where are the revolutionary conversations happening today? In blogs? On Facebook? Via tweets? Or whatever those things are called. I understand that one person's terrorist threat is another person's revolutionary hero. You may have heard that phrase in various forms. Perhaps making it difficult to understand the word revolutionary. Maybe we don't want revolutionary conversations to happen anymore in this country. Maybe we have gotten as revolutionary as we are capable of becoming. And that would be sad. This is what I want the 4th of July to be about. Revolutionary conversations. I want the 4th of July to be about listening for our song, our country's song. And I think that song is there in the writings of those amazing people who wrote the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence. I want the 4th of July to be about studying these founding fathers and the mothers and learning more about them and conversing about the amazing gift they gave us and how we can keep it alive. How do we do that in a culture that is all about distractions? How do we live deliberately in this culture? How do we find our way? Because I think that we have lost our way, going far astray from what the founders envisioned. It is up to us to keep their progressive ideas alive. Kowalski says that the founders have been spiritually sanitized, a process that still continues. It would be wonderful to unsanitize them and make more people aware of just how liberal and progressive they really were. We owe it to them and to ourselves to stand with them, rank by rank, in every age. Now that would make the 4th of July worth celebrating.
Closing words. I'm going to do a little quick experiment with you. Let me say the closing words the way I have edited them. They're written by John Murray, who was born in 1741. One of those universalist preachers from England who came the highways and byways. Give the people something of your new vision. You can possess a small light, but uncover it. Let it shine. Use it in order to bring more light and understanding to the hearts and minds of men and women. Give them not hell, but hope and courage. Preach the kindness. Preach kindness and everlasting love. That's my gift. Go in peace. Greet your neighbors and stay for sound.